Mr. Connor is a registered representative and managing principal with Connor Wealth Management. Securities offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. Opinions expressed on this show are strictly those of the host, its guests, and callers, and not those of WLVL, its management, staff, or sponsors. Nothing contained in this program should be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell a security, and if applicable, only after the prospectus has been read and understood by the customer. These decisions can only be made after consideration of an investor's investment objective and the investment suitability.
Good morning, everybody. Today is October 15th. It's Friday, and we're here with Eric Connors from Connors Wealth Management. And he knows everything about money. We're happy to have you here this morning, Eric. We're Eric Squared, as John calls us. So how you doing this morning?
What's going on? Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
You know, I'm really happy. I'm happy to be here, happy to be doing this. I just love this place, and I hope it shows.
Yeah. It's like a 15-minute coffee break for you in between Tradio and this, right? You
get to, it is.
You get to take a quick breather and lubricate the pipes a little bit with some coffee or
that's
something,
right,
and then get going again.
Yep, that's what it's all about. It's a fast-paced environment here, though. It's really nice. Time goes fast, and we get a lot done, and hopefully the folks out there listening are enjoying and learning, just like I am.
There you go.
So, what's the top of the day's news today in the financial world?
Well, it's it's always something on the headlines. It's always something in the news type of what you envision as moving the market. Right now, we've had a couple nice up days. Market seems to be a little healthier after its September, I'll say, doldrums, right? It wasn't much of a swoon or anything like that, but a little bit of doldrums. And politics-wise, they've extended out the debt ceiling discussion for 2 months, and that seems to have kind of calmed the market down and moved higher. Interest rates have backed off just a little bit, so that helps growth stocks, tech stocks, sort of get moving to the upside again, and that pushes the indexes higher. And I think that's really what we've seen is you had a little bit of pressure in some of the bigger names like an Apple, maybe $15 off of its all-time high, and now wow, it's come back a few bucks, and Amazon isn't near its all-time high. They're off by 10% or more. But that partially becomes an interest rate thing, right? So we talk about that a lot. And rates have moderated. They're not clicking higher every day in the last week or so. And in fact, it backed off just a teeny bit. And that gives the stocks a little room to move higher.
That's good. Yeah, I was listening to Fox News in between radio and here. And they said that retail sales are up 0.8% for the month. But they're actually blaming that on the price increases.
Yeah, so there's always – it's always sort of hard to dig into those numbers, right? When you hear 0.8%, you don't think that's very dramatic. Well, if you think of that as 12 months out of the year,
that's a lot of money.
That becomes a big increase in terms of actual sales. That's mm-hmm. right. And, yes, there's always a sort of little mental adjustment you have to sort of do as saying, well, where did that increase come from, right? Is it actual volume? Are they selling actually more units of whatever, or are they just getting a stronger price? And let's face it, right? We came off of a closed down economy last year. And what we're seeing this year, I've got to say, is entirely predictable in terms of some of the pricing pressure that we're seeing. The dramatic erosion or just degradation of certain demand on certain products last year during the pandemic has reversed itself. And so this year you've got general economic stability for a large portion of the economy, and those dollars are searching out for products to buy. Right. So if last year you had production problems that have continued into this year, And you magnify that by the fact that we were very locked down last year and now we're much more mobile. You've got energy pressure that, again, entirely predictable, right? The usage, the oil usage we have is 5 million barrels a day more than a year ago at this time. So I would just say, of course prices are higher, right? There's no actual shortage of oil.
Right.
It's just that the demand has gone higher, and I know I've talked about that. But you look at that in other areas of the economy, and yes, the same sort of thing, right? The prices are trickling through and showing pressure in food, in consumer products, anything that was energy-based. You know, the price of oil dictates part of the price of plastic because plastic is petroleum-based, and that trickles through to tons and tons of products in our society as well. So we've got some pressure, but, you know, you balance that out with the fact that you've got an increase in income that's at a level that we haven't seen in this country in a very, very, very long time. And I wrote it down, sort of one of my last little notes for the meeting or for the show today was to comment on the Social Security increase that's coming for 2022. It's 5.9% as an increase.
That's substantial.
And it's substantial. That's right. And people, you know, sort of, depending on how they want to grumble or respond to the world, they're like, oh, my gosh, that's so much. But it's a reflection of this relatively higher level of consumption that creates some inflation in the economy. And you've got to sort of keep in mind what the last 10 years of inflation and Social Security increases have looked like. It's been peanuts, right?
That's right.
It's been incredibly minor.
Mm-hmm.
And seniors on Social Security see some of the inflation in this economy that doesn't show up in the reported numbers over the last few years, which maybe people don't quite understand what I mean. Seniors get hit with inflation that doesn't show up in the normal numbers, right? So as medication has gone up or as co-pays have changed, some of that does not get reflected in consumer price index information, yet it disproportionately hits the seniors on Social Security benefits, right? The older you are, the more likely you are to have prescriptions or multiple prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
So as all of those increases have trickled in when their benefit was only going up 0.5% in the year or 1.1%, it's not making up for the inflation that they've been seeing. So, you know, I'll take the 5.9 on 1 year for all the Social Security benefits out there. I think that's fantastic for them.
Sure it is. We're talking with Eric Connors from Connors Wealth Management. If you have any questions for Mr. Connor, you can call 433-1433. We'll be happy to take your calls and questions. It's funny you mentioned the inflation thing. I looked up the last, like, 4 years. In 2018, it was at 1.9. 2019 was 2.3. 2020 was 1.4. 2021, the Fed predicted 1.8, but it ended up being 5.39. Currently, right at this moment, it's a 4.2. Those numbers are correct, right?
Yeah.
And so if we got a 5.39 inflation, they got a 5.9 increase, they might break even.
Correct.
So that's not a bad thing. It's worse than being in the hole.
Yeah, and that's sort of my point over the last few years is that the way the number is calculated has not helped seniors actually keep pace with the kind of inflation that they are incurring. So the fact that this year it's a little above normal in terms of it's bigger than what your inflation number actually is.
Right.
That's fine. Totally fine.
Sure.
Makes up a little bit of the deficit over the last couple of years.
Okay, that directly correlates to the value of the dollar that we have right now. From what I read, it's speculated that what you can buy for $100 today, next year this time it will cost you $112. So that's the value of the dollar fluctuating, and that's the prediction that I read.
Yeah, Does that
make sense?
That seems a little off to me.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah, well, I would say it more like a dollar today. you know, if you're looking at a 5% inflation rate for what we're seeing right now, that would tell you that a dollar today buys you 95 cents worth of stuff next year.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. The $1.12 seems a little much.
Well, you know, that's the joys of doing internet research is I try to find at least two different sources that confirm what the numbers are when I can, because it's time consuming and want to reflect accurate information. And sometimes it's questionable, you know, is this right or not? That's why I'm, you know, kind of asking you as well as pointing out what some of the numbers are.
Yeah. And in that setting, they're guessing at what next year looks like as well.
Sure they are.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, for years and years and years, the sort of base assumption for an inflation estimate was just a flat 3%.
Mm-hmm.
Just that's where it was. And if you look at over the last 20 years, I don't think we've even averaged 2.25%. So if you assumed 3 and are only getting 2.25 over a long period of time, boy, have your assumptions really gotten out of whack.
Right, but that's a win.
Correct. If it relates to you saving enough money, it's worked out the right way. If it's in anticipation of some sort of business expense, it's worked out the right way because it's been more money in your pocket. If it's on the other side and it was you figuring out some sort of revenue number, well, then you're wildly off over a long period of time. Like if you were a landlord trying to assume what kind of rent increase you could have gotten it over that 20-year period, you might be wildly off in the valuation of the property. So, it's always a challenge to decide what your sources are in terms of what estimates are they using or what's the rationale behind the estimates.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And as far as the landlord thing goes, they're just – it's a good guess, right? Well,
yeah.
It's a bad guess.
Yeah, right. I mean, we could – I don't think you and I could have a fully correct discussion as to how some of them are calculating the rent that they want to charge,
right.
You know, sort of the base assumption is I want to get as much as I think I can get, right? And they may be right, they may be wrong.
Right, and hopefully whoever's there doesn't take advantage of the I don't have to pay the rent thing that's
Correct.
A friend of mine has somebody squatting in his house for over a year now, and they're like, yeah, we're not paying your rent, but yet he still has to pay his school taxes and county taxes on the house, and he's not a wealthy guy. He's, you know, he's just a normal Joe like you and me.
Yeah, no, we've had callers on that very topic over over this 18 months, and I don't have a perfect answer for that at all. Right? Like,
right.
If the government sends you home and tells you you can't work, yes, we need to figure out some sort of benefit package to keep those people afloat. And that's true of the businesses that are told to close your doors. And if you tell the renters and mortgage holders that they don't need to pay their rent or their mortgage, yeah, the last part in there in the whole government package of mandates and help, the last package becomes, well, what are you going to do for the landlords, right? Like,
right.
It's not about the big guys. It's about the little guys. And that was the longest thing, the slowest thing to come along, was creating some sort of package that related to the landlords and how was that going to take place. And some communities were excellent where they said, look at, we're going to not do a tax foreclosure auction because you're impaired because your tenants don't have to. And I couldn't even tell you what communities did that. I just know that I've read it over time that some were doing that and look like, all right, we'll just figure it out later. You know, we'll let the government do their thing and we'll let bailout packages happen. And we'll let you have a little time to get caught up on any potential tax payments that you need to make because you couldn't make them because your tenants weren't paying. So,
yeah, and that's, you know, and the packages, you know, they're useful. I mean, they're helpful. When I own my music store, we of course had to shut down, and I applied for one of those things. I got $1,000, which is better than not $1,000 because it covered 1 month's worth of my expenses.
Yeah.
Now the other months that I was shut down, I was just kind of dipping into my savings and just had to bite the bullet. But again, you know, it's residual. Everything comes back. It bounced back.
Yeah.
And we're doing okay now. The new owner's doing fine. But this kind of is an interest. It's a good segue, I think. You know, we talk about getting people back to work, you know, so we can start paying our bills. People are spending money like crazy. And the national unemployment rate is at, what, 5.4?
I think it dipped even lower. But, yeah, okay. In that vicinity, that's right. Right, yeah.
And then New York State, though, was 7.4.
Is it? Yeah.
And then Niagara County is 7.7. So what in tarnation's going on here?
Well, it's an amazing thing. I know one of the statistics that I had is how Nevada is not doing great unemployment-wise, and I would assume that relates a lot to the travel and hospitality and casino business. And Nebraska is actually doing fantastic with unemployment. They're at like 2.2% because really? The people that are there are working, right? They're it's not all farmers, right? Omaha is a big city. So you've got a population that's very much on the job and looking for work. But I just read an article this morning. I think Time magazine was the one putting it out. And it's about the large quantity of people that not only are unemployed, but the dramatic number that are quitting. And it's remarkable to see them compile the statistics. You're talking 7 months of increasing amounts of people quitting. And the August number was something like 4.3 million people quit their job in August. And I would point out that in the past, we've had discussions about the enhanced unemployment and was that the thing keeping people from looking for a job? And I had said, well, the numbers are showing that in the states that removed the enhanced unemployment first or early, they were not seeing an uptick in employment. They were not seeing those jobs getting filled, even with the removal of the enhanced unemployment. So to read this article and hear that the number has increased 7 straight months and into August became 4.3 million people quitting in 1 month, it's just remarkable. They're not, there isn't one magic bullet answer about it. It, you know, the end assumptions you can make in this moment in time is that they're not satisfied in their jobs. They're not willing to put up with the conditions of their job. So that might be a lack of hour flexibility. It might be a work from home issue or a hybrid issue. But a lot of the reports that are coming through is simply the schedule of that job does not fit into what I need in my life. And a lot of times it becomes a childcare issue or a healthcare issue with a family member, right? So someone that needs your attention, whether it's an infant or just a sick family member or something like that. And it'll take a very long time to sort of really dig into these numbers and see where the end result is. But it's a little bit of an, in the short term, it's a little bit of an unsolvable problem for some businesses. And I think we can say we're seeing that as we look at the help wanted signs up and down Transit Road, right? The businesses that used to advertise for $12 an hour went to $14 an hour, went to $15 an hour, went to $16 an hour, and they're still not getting workers to apply to show up and keep coming. But it's remarkable to know that even in the absence of that enhanced unemployment, that has not pushed tons and tons of people into the workforce. I think a very broad statement, though, is that by and large, the highly skilled workforce that's out there are not in that quitting category. So if you've got, let's say, more of a white-collar office position, you're probably by default in a situation where the hours are a little more flexible. You can potentially have a little work from home. You can, as long as you get your work done, it doesn't matter. Whereas the problem jobs seem to be much more of the blue-collar, hands-on, large duration of time jobs, right? The ones where they need you to be there for 8 hours plus the lunch break – day after day after day, those seem to be the jobs that are having much more trouble getting filled. And it's not directly, it's not solely because of the hourly wage that's being offered. So it's an interesting situation where certain job types are having this, you know, over and over and over, they're having the problems filling the roles. And it's not necessarily about a skill set directly, but it's an issue of what are the conditions of the job? How much, you know, is it 8 to 4, 8 to 5, 9 to 5, or is it, all right, I got to get my 40 hours a week in or 37 and a half hours a week in, and it doesn't really matter when I get those hours as long as I get the job done. That seems to be the number one predictor of where the problem is right now for these companies filling those jobs. Does it resolve itself? I don't know. How it compares to the trouble we're seeing when you think of the consumer goods problems of boats sitting out in the Pacific Ocean trying to get into the port of LA to be unloaded. You know, you hear all kinds of issues of there's not enough truck drivers to move the whatever the containers are called, that slips my mind right now. Once they're taken off the boat and processed, that they're having trouble getting them onto enough trucks, or that they're not getting onto the train cars fast enough to be transported across the country, or that there's not enough longshoremen to literally get the containers off the boats to begin with. You know, that stuff is beyond my level of knowing enough information. I just know locally the businesses that are challenge to find workers, I don't have any magic words of wisdom for how they're going to find that. I mean, there's no snapping of a fingers to get people to show up if they don't want to do those jobs, you know?
Right. I think there's a mindset, isn't there, too, that, you know, for the entry-level jobs, the ones that we see signs up and down in transit, we actually have sponsors that are advertising on the radio looking for help. I've never heard that before in my life.
Yeah.
But, you know, those jobs are designed as entry-level jobs to get people into the workforce, get some gas money in their car, you know, young people, or if they're elderly and just want to do something in retirement, make some extra cash. Not designed to be a career move. And so when I hear people saying, well, I can't feed my family on $15 an hour, I'm going, well, you're probably got the wrong job. You know, what is your skill set? Can you find a job in the widget factory that needs somebody from 8 to 5, it's probably going to pay a little better, have better benefits, you know, as far as health insurance and all that jazz. And I just think that there's a skewed mindset at some point where people think that working at a fast food joint is a career move.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But you touched on the magic word in there, which is the skill set, right? So if your level of training or abilities aren't real high, right, like let's just say you didn't go to college, you didn't go to vocational school, you don't have technical skills, you don't have computer skills, maybe you don't have people skills. Maybe, you know, like you just keep knocking off all these things and you go, okay, well, you're left with not a lot of great options, right? So to your point, so a lot of jobs out there are not meant to be 40 hours a week of for something that really should be 4 hours at a shift or 6 hours at a shift, right? So that is a different sort of discussion. And so in this day and age, right, there are openings on every construction trade business. There are openings on almost anything you are skilled, known as a skilled tradesman or working with your hands, there are openings.
And it's good money.
It is fantastic money.
Yes. You know, so again, I think it falls down to personal responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately for that period of a year or wherever where people are just sitting down watching TV, it changed society. Society is different. Plus, we got the millennials coming up, which has a different mindset from the boomers.
Yeah, so there's always the transition.
Right.
In any shock to the economy, you always have that older tier of worker who walks away a little bit early and they remove themselves from the workforce, right? So let's, what I mean by that is, let's say someone was geared up to work till age 65 if everything was good. Well, everything wasn't good. A pandemic hit, you know, job situations changed. They might have decided to walk away early at 63 and a half or at 63. And so you've got 40 years of experience that just walked out the door and is now at home.
Right.
And that needs to get replaced, to your point, by the next generation who doesn't necessarily – it's not so much about a work ethic per se, but it's about the job expectation, right? So you lose someone who knows the ins and out of a factory or knows the ins and out of a location or every – they've got the historic detail of the last 20 years at a firm of any kind. And you're bringing in someone brand new that just doesn't have the life experience, that just doesn't have that historical knowledge of what's going on, of course the productivity is going to decline, right? And so that's sort of like a – that happens anyways. That happens not even during a pandemic. That just happens during any kind of recession or jolt in American history. It could even be a war situation where you've got older people that just – decided again to move out early.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you've got a lot of people that are unprepared for replacing those workers, right? And so I used to make comments in some discussions of saying, you know, a young kid, there aren't a lot of kids in West Virginia growing up hoping to be a coal miner today. Right. They saw how hard their father or their grandfather worked. They're not really anxious to be a coal miner. But if that's the only job they've got, they'll go do it. Because
right.
Let's face it. Right. We're generally speaking, hardworking Americans. That's how.
Absolutely.
If that's the job, that's what. But you didn't necessarily aspire to that job as a generation of West Virginians. So today you could maybe twist that around to lots of other professions, and it's where the kids, the younger adults are going, yeah, I saw how hard mom or dad worked, and that's not really what I'm looking for. And so they don't have the skill set, or they don't have the drive or the ambition or whatever. And so then it leads to, how do you solve it? And if we sort of twist that into an investment thesis for a minute, that becomes, you're probably interested in finding companies that are able to overcome that sort of situation. So maybe they are about productivity gains, or maybe they are about technology versus pure manpower in the job. And there are many examples of that just crushing old businesses in this country. And if you go back 40 years, it was Microsoft choosing the software route versus IBM on building the computers themselves. Fast forward 40 years, Microsoft is like the third largest company in the world by market capitalization, and IBM is, they're still big, but they are an afterthought in terms of the technology pecking order at this point. I mean, they're probably the 50th biggest tech company, or the 100th biggest. I actually wouldn't know. I'm just guessing.
Right.
I mean, there are dozens of companies above them, every one of them mastering the software side. And yet it was one decision 40 years ago that led to the situation now.
That's
and
right.
So you've got that decision in your investment portfolio all the time. And you can use lots of examples of it even in recent times, right? That idea of Tesla in the last 10 years versus GM or Ford. In stock market behavior, it's no contest. Tesla has absolutely demolished them.
Yep.
It doesn't mean that I'm telling you to buy Tesla, but it's just that idea of where does the market view those opportunities and how do they value those companies? You know, there's other ways to think of it that we all know of or that we've talked about, right? There's going to come a day when you've got cashierless stores everywhere. Those jobs are just going to, there's, I think I gave the statistic one time, there's like 3 million cashier jobs in this country. How many are going to be left in the future when Amazon has like this, I call it a magic shopping cart. Mm-hmm. You just put the product in the cart and it totals up what your costs are. You don't need a cashier. You don't even need to self-scan it. It just knows what's in your cart. You know, that sort of advance, you can't stop it. You know, there's not going to be some government mandate that comes out that says, oh, you absolutely are going to still have live human cashiers at the level you had in, you know, pick the year 2016, and never decrease. So those, that big broad thinking opens up investment thoughts of where you can look for the next generation of growth, or how our business is going to evolve, right?
Right. And speaking of managing your portfolio, there's many people, I think, like me, who wasn't smart enough to get into the game in our youth. And so I got in the game when I was in my 40s. And so I'm not wealthy by any chance, you know, but contributions. It's like, you're not going to build wealth if you don't contribute to it.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, the interest rates aren't real high. And so how do we get people to, if they're working at the widget factory or wherever, making a decent wage, instead of going down to so-and-so's club and buying that 72-inch TV, how do we get them to invest and just keep plugging a little bit away, a little bit away, a little bit away, because a nickel turns to a dime turns to a quarter,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What, how can we kind of help people to get into the mindset, if I save today, I'm going to be okay tomorrow?
Yeah, that's one of the absolute biggest questions and quandaries that have existed now for a long, long time. If you spend all of your money all the time and haven't saved anything, how are you actually going to get to the point of retiring or of changing your situation, right? If you're if you're always down to your last 20 bucks, how do you eventually handle inflation or life changes, right? If you're spending all your money but you want to get married and have three kids, where's that all going to come from? So, you know, I mentioned in the past that when my son started working, we opened up a Roth IRA for him. And now my second child started working and we opened up a Roth IRA for her. And if she's listening, she likes to joke around that at my office, she doesn't technically have a client folder, even though she has an account, and that's still true, but sometimes she listens and she gets a grumble on her face about not having an actual client folder. And right, so in your question, like for me, I'm doing it for my kids from the get-go. I'm telling them, listen, you're going to put in some of your money, I'm going to match some of your money, and we're going to start this Roth IRA. And the reason being, they've got 50 years until they retire. So you pointed out you didn't really start saving until your 40s. It's not that you can't still acquire money, but you got to save a lot more when you start later. How do you start early? Listen, it's the simplest part of just saying, don't spend all your money.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to do, right? We're in a consumer-based society. We've got things always tickling our interest level, right? Whether it's going to a Bills game, right? They're back winning. People want to go to the Bills games again. Or we've been locked up for 18 months, and so they want to take a vacation. And I mean, I've had a lot of people that come in and they tell me how they don't have any money saved and they charged a vacation to Disney World for $1,800. I'm like, well, why did you go to Disney World if you had no money and now you've got it on a credit card and now you can't make the credit card payment? Like, that stuff just doesn't make sense to me. I always want to have compassion for people in a bad situation, but I don't understand how consistently some will overspend for what they have. Frivolously, right? Like, there is no God-given right to go to Disney World when you don't have any savings. I'm sorry, like, go camping, right? It's a lot cheaper. Don't go to Disney. It really is a bit of a mindset, though, where you're going to say, listen, come heck or high water, I'm going to start saving $50 a month. And after I get in the groove of that, I'm going to find a way to make it 60. Or I'm going to find a way to make it 80. And it is very, very true that when you start out early, it is not a lot of money to end up 30 and 40 years later with a very good sum of money if the market, if you've invested for growth and if the market has worked out in that time, right? I'm not trying to predict the future per se, but if you just shove it in the bank, you're not getting a lot of interest. You know you're not getting a lot of interest. You don't have any volatility to it,
right.
But you're not really getting paid any kind of growth amount. You're just earning a very small amount of interest. Whereas if you take on the risk of the market and you do that for a very long time period, you've got a pretty high chance of accumulating a good chunk of money.
Sure.
And you can do it with a very modest sum of money, really. $50 a month at age 20. And if you just did that for the next 30 years, you'd be shocked at how only 50 bucks a month grew to probably, and I wouldn't even guess, but it's in the hundreds of thousands range, and it was only $600 a year.
Right.
Like, but the to your point,
consistency.
You got to get started, and you got to keep at it. And when those raises come, you put some of the raise into your increased savings, right? Instead of just taking the raise and spending all the money, take some of it and increase the savings rate. If you get a 3% raise, bump your savings up another 1%, right? So you still got some more money in your pocket, but you've also increased the percentage that you're saving each month. And so that's the thing, right? So parents out there, grandparents out there, if there's a way for you to get your kids or grandkids started early, do it. It's one of the most fundamental benefits you can give them, right? So in our society today, you've got like 2/3 of the people that are 65 and over that have almost no savings in this country. Like, it's really, really remarkable at how hard an entire generation or generation and a half has had of acquiring any wealth. And it really is a function of you've had a fantastic time in the stock market overall for 40 years, right? There's been obviously some really big bumps in the road. But if you were born in 1960, and so in the early 80s, you would have left college or gotten into the workforce. If you had started saving a little bit of money during all that stock market behavior for the next 40 years, where you're now into your early 60s, you would absolutely have a good chunk of money and potentially a great chunk of money. Because I've got some of those clients right now. Mm-hmm. And back in those days, you couldn't save a lot of money in your IRA, right? Today, someone 50 and above can put $7,000 a year into their IRA. Back then, you couldn't do more than $2,000.
Right.
And most people weren't even coming close to that. But I've got people that are clients now that are sitting at $3 million of value in their IRAs because there was just such a long period of time that they were able to grow that money.
Sure.
It's absolutely wonderful for them. But, you know, again, basically 2/3 of the people at 65 and over have almost no savings whatsoever.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. You know, Joe and Mary Ann been married for 30 years. He worked at the widget factory. She did something on the side or whatever. They have their home with 2.5 bathrooms, 3/4 of an acre. They have 2 cars in the driveway. What are they going to need in the bank to retire when they decide that they're going to get out of the workforce? How much money do they need?
Yeah, it's a good question, but it doesn't have a great, perfect answer.
Okay.
So there's one of the big determinant factors around here. Well, actually, not around here. I shouldn't say it like that. Becomes what are your guaranteed source of income, right? So you're going to have Social Security, even if the spouse, not man or female, even if the spouse never worked outside the home, they will be entitled to 1/2 of the spouse for a spousal benefit. They'll be entitled to 1/2 the value of the working spouse. But the big thing becomes, is there a pension or is there no pension? Right. So around here, you've got a generation of Harrison / GM / Delphi retirees with a pension. They are in a different boat compared to the worker at a different factory who had no pension. It's just different having a guaranteed pool of money coming in. So you've got government workers, teachers, municipal employees, firemen, police officers that have a pension system that's very predictable and very sound, and they will be able to combine that pension with Social Security. Those people do not need as much money in terms of savings to have a good slash prosperous retirement. The absence of a pension, where you're now only looking at the Social Security side being your guaranteed money coming in, you need a bigger pool of money to have that comfortable retirement, right? So there's a rule of thumb that says, and there's a lot of reasons to not stick with it fully, but an old rule of thumb becomes that you can do a 4% withdrawal from your investment account and hope that it grows over time. So meaning if you had $1 million saved, you'd have $40,000 of income. So if you take Social Security for you and your spouse, and let's say that totals $30,000, you'd have $70,000 of income coming in, and you'd if you had $1 million saved. And obviously it just changes if you only have $200,000 saved. Yeah, you're not taking $40,000 a year out of a $200,000 account.
Right.
Or you're not doing it for very long, right? Because you're just going to burn it up and it's going to be gone.
Yeah.
So that 4% can be a quick rule of thumb, but I would tell people that as they sit down with me, we're going to talk about that in a much different fashion, because we're going to look at where your expenses are, what's fixed and what's a variable expense, what's your age, what's your life expectancy, what's your relative health. And we're going to determine that maybe 4% isn't the right number for you. Maybe it's more like 5.5%. And if you're doing a 5.5% withdrawal, then you don't need quite as big a pot of money to be able to live. But, you know, let's face it. If you're walking out of the workforce at whatever age, 60, 65, 68, and you've only got $12,000 saved, that's not any kind of cushion for anything, right? Like you're going down, let's say you just go down to only Social Security. How do you pay for house repairs? How do you pay for a car repair at that? You know, you need some level of savings to keep going through retirement successfully. So it's not one pure number. It's a bit of a process to get to it, but it all starts with saving some money and some planning and living below your means. Right. If you spend every dollar that comes in, listen, you could make $1 million a year. If you spend $1 million a year on that salary, you're broke.
That's right.
You're not rich. You're broke.
That's right.
So
there are people that make $40,000 a year that are wealthier than people that make millions of dollars a year because they don't spend it all.
Correct. Correct.
And it's your debt to income ratio, right?
Yeah. We've had a client in the past. She has since passed away. She wasn't quite local. She was in Lancaster. She was a retired teacher. She never made more than $13,000 in her job during her working years. And yet, because her and her husband had saved, she ended up with an account value that was $1.6 million or so. And I can remember her asking me one time, she's like, "Now, where did that come from?" And I said, "All those $50 contributions that you saved, and decades had gone past, and the market was on your side, it just grew and grew and grew." And she was really just dumbfounded that on her modest salary back then, that over a long time period, that it had grown to that level of value. She was absolutely amazed.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's just, I love those kind of stories.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Because she's a humble person, just did her thing.
Completely.
That's great.
And then she was able to give to charity at the end. She didn't have kids.
Sure.
And she was able to, we worked with her to create some charitable accounts. And, you know, she's now been gone a decade, and yet her life savings continue to give back to the community that she loves. So it's worked out perfect.
That's what it's all about. Well, listen, we've been here with Eric Connor from Connor Wealth Management. It's been a glorious conversation. Thank you for all of your insights and wisdom. I look forward to doing it again in 2 weeks with you. And remember, folks, if you have any questions during these programs, you can call during the show and he will answer to the best of his ability. And so we hope that you have a glorious weekend and enjoy yourself. Thank you, Mr. Connor. It's been a great conversation.
Go Bills.
Yeah, there you go. We'll talk to you soon.